98FM. Now that's what I call Sport Podcast.
It's a very big welcome to Now That's What I Call Sport on 98FM.
This is 98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport with Jamie Moore.
Yes, a very good morning. It is the morning after the night before, and if Euro 2016 is anything to go by, there will be some very sore heads in Paris this morning as Ireland fans wake up after the post-win celebrations last night. What a night at the Stade de France. We'll relive it with that man, Johnny Sexton, Joe Schmidt, Shane Byrne and some Ireland fans in just a second. We'll also be going big on the Dubs with the boys and girls in action this weekend. How would you like to win a family pass to the Dubs doubleheader in the Allianz League at Croke Park next weekend? More info on that soon. And we'll also be finding out why there's no hunger in paradise when it comes to young players trying to make it as professional footballers in England. But there is only one place to start.
98
Last ounces of reserve. They're being eked out now. They're leaving nothing behind them, this Ireland team, in a bid to force the opening, but neither are the French. Some ground being made now. Sexton from outside the 10-metre line. It's spinning. It's spinning.
Yes, an incredible finish is right. That's TV3's Dave McIntyre describing the closing minutes at the Stade de France last night. And I am joined in studio now by 98FM's Derek Ryan and Nathan Whelan. Men, good morning.
Good morning.
What a moment. We're all a bit happy, aren't
what
we, today?
What a moment, yeah. We went from despair to joy last night. Like, in the 82nd minute, I was going, listen, lads, this is not going to happen. Let's give it up here. Give up the goal. It's not happening. And then that, from so far at the pitch, it was a ridiculous kick. What a risk to take from Johnny, but it paid off.
Yeah, someone had sent me a Snapchat of the match, and I looked down at my phone, and as I looked up, I just saw Sexton about to kick the ball, and I was
came out of absolutely nowhere. And the position of it, like, he shouldn't have taken the kick, really, like, in terms of the risk of it. 82nd minute, 41 phases through, he shouldn't have taken the kick, but thankfully he did, and what a moment, what a win as well.
And then, Nathan, you're just in slow motion then wondering, is it going to actually make it as far as getting over the bar?
It's one of them moments that you look back and remember, because I grabbed the first man standing beside me. I didn't know who he was, but he got the biggest hug I have ever given anyone. And he loved it. So did I.
Let's hear from that man, Johnny Sexton, now speaking to TV3 immediately after the game last night. Yes, an incredible finish is right. That's TV3's Dave McIntyre describing the closing minutes at the Stade de France last night. And I am joined in studio now by 98FM's Derek Ryan and Nathan Whelan. Men, good morning.
Good morning. What a moment, eh?
We're all a bit happy, aren't
what
we, today?
What a moment, yeah. We went from despair to joy last night. Like, in the 82nd minute, I was going, listen, lads, this is not going to happen. Let's give it up here. Give up the goal. It's not going to happen. And then that, from so far at the pitch, it was a ridiculous kick. What a risk to take from Johnny, but it paid off.
Yeah, right. Someone had sent me a Snapchat of the match, and I looked down at my phone, and as I looked up, I just saw Sexton about to kick the ball, and I was
came out of absolutely nowhere. And the position of it, like, he shouldn't have taken the kick, really, like, in terms of the risk of it. 82nd minute, 41 phases through, he shouldn't have taken the kick, but thankfully he did, and what a moment, what a win as well.
And then, Nathan, you're just in slow motion then wondering, is it going to actually make it as far as getting over the bar?
It's one of them moments that you look back and remember, because I grabbed the first man standing beside me. I didn't know who he was, but he got the biggest hug I have ever given anyone. And he loved it. So did I.
Let's hear from that man, Johnny Sexton, now speaking to TV3 immediately after the game last night.
I think when you always know you're going to have one chance in games like that, when it's touch and go. We could have put to bed with the penalty or snapshot it, and I just wanted one more chance, and it's nice to get another chance. I've been in that position before where you don't get another chance, and just happy for the lads. It's great effort. It was a scrappy game with the conditions the way it were, and the way Nigel reffed it was very scrappy. You know, we let them come in off their feet at times, and yeah, we got a couple of decisions against us, but we stuck in there, and if we get what we want to get in the championship, we'll look back at that last 10 minutes and the character we showed.
Now, Derek, one of the worst things about being a journalist working at a live match is if something big happens late in the game, you have to change your whole story, your headline, your report.
Yeah,
and I'm sure
all
the newspaper editors last night were writing how boring and bad Ireland were, that they'd lost to France in Paris. All of a sudden, okay, lads, we need to write a new headline involving our new hero, or our continuing hero, but our hero of the night, Johnny Sexton, and the newspaper has certainly done that.
Yeah, it wasn't even the defeat that was going to happen last night. It was more the performance. And like I say, I think everyone was very negative after 82 minutes. And 82 and a half minutes, everyone was very positive. Of course, I wonder what the headline is today. It's all about Johnny. Here's Johnny in the Sport. That's a fantastic headline. It had to be, really, didn't it? Here's Johnny in the Sun Sport today. Sexton seals it at the death. And Johnny looking more surprised than I think anybody in the whole stadium and in the whole country as well in Ireland that the ball actually went over, because it was so far out, it didn't look like it was going to go over. Drop of magic as well in the Irish Daily Mail. It's all kicking off in the Star and the Irish Sunday Mirror. Cheers, Johnny. Deadly boot of Sexton. Nick's unlikely late win for Ireland and Paris.
Now, from the newspaper reaction to some fans outside the Stade de France in Paris last night, speaking to Off the Ball's Uchin Langan, we wonder how those fans are feeling this morning after the celebrations. But here's how they were feeling directly after the game.
Absolutely amazing, right? Coming towards the end, there was a lot of the lads behind us. They were like, allez, la bleu. And I was going on, and I was hoping and praying that, you know, Ireland would come through it, and we did. We done it, and in the last minute kick, boom, done. You cannot beat it. Absolutely not.
Oh my God! It was unreal. It was insane. Words cannot describe.
It was amazing. Unbelievable. Johnny Sexton is a hero.
We were so nervous towards the end, and yay, we won!
Unbelievable.
Lads, what did you think of that Johnny Sexton?
Amazing!
You can't say that on the radio, lads.
You can't. Thankfully you bleeped it out this morning.
We love Dublin Talks on 98FM, and they have their very own censor machine for all the some bad language on that show, so we had to get that out there. Oisín had briefed these fans, please don't curse in the interview. We're going to video it for the Off the Ball Facebook page.
After what happened, it's fine. After what happened, it's all good.
Yeah, but amazing. I love the raw emotion of the fans directly after these matches.
Because I love the emotion on the pitch. It's very rare for Irish rugby players or any rugby players to kind of jump on each other and celebrate in that fashion. But I think everyone was just shocked. And the best image was Johnny looking at it going, I can't believe this is actually going to go over the bar.
Yeah.
That whole 3 seconds between the time he kicked it and the time it dropped, it looked like he was convinced it was going to miss. And when he saw it going over, he nearly jumped around going, is that after going over? And then all the players jumping on top of him. That you never see that in rugby, so it's just brilliant to see.
It's definitely going to go down as one of the best nights in Irish rugby. 100%.
Yes. And I loved the woolly hats with the bobbles on them that the Irish coaches were wearing in the stands to keep them wet or to keep them dry from the rain last night. A man wearing one of those hats is Joe Schmidt, and the Ireland head coach was quite a calm figure when speaking to Oisín after the game about the winning moment.
It's pretty hard to explain how you feel when you think that the game has got away and you've let it slip and suddenly you've grabbed it because of I felt an incredible team effort to work their way up the pitch about 40-45 metres and then to add on at the end of it a 40 metre drop goal. I think it was fairly inspirational. Even the fact that so many people had to be involved. We had to drop kick the ball to start with, and Ian Henderson got it back. We played a number of phases. A cross kick for Keith Earls, who leapt 3 or 4 feet into the air to claim it. We felt we got very close to earning some reward. When it was very, very slow ball, it was difficult to clear our ball a number of times, but we didn't appear to be going to get much of a chance there. And then when he struck the drop goal, I was just willing it to have enough distance to get over, because it looked, when he struck it, it might. And when it did, I think the coaching staff, we all kind of stood up as one. And
Shane Byrne, welcome back to Dublin's 98FM. Shane, how are you?
Not too bad, not too bad at all.
Now, Shane, I watched the game last night with a mate of mine, and he said to me, are you talking about this on the radio in the morning? And I said, yes, I am. And he goes, well, good luck to you trying to analyse this. That was after about 80 minutes. And then, of course, we know what happened next, Shane. You've been around Irish rugby a long time. Is that and was that the most and best memorable moment in Irish Six Nations history? And if not, Shane, what was better?
Yeah, no, you have to say that that was just an incredible build-up. Let's just take that in isolation, that 41 phases of rugby it took to do that. So that's flawless rugby for that amount of time. Great team effort, great control by Conor Murray. Nobody really ever takes a drop goal from 45 yards out. It looked almost like a panic decision that it was just, oh my God, we're running out of time, we better take it. But if you actually look at it closely, which you have several times now, Sexton called for the ball. He was happy. It was built on, you know, he was happy to take it then, which honestly makes it, you know, the bravery of the guy. There's another way of putting it as well. You know, the way that he struck the ball was absolutely magnificent. And what an end to a game. The game itself, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but that instance itself, you know, you could almost say a defining moment, hopefully this year, you could say leading on to something greater, but a defining moment for Johnny Sexton's career.
Yeah, and you felt as those phases were going on, as you mentioned, it was 41 in the end before he scored and we won the game. But you're wondering, you know, is there going to be a chance? Is there going to be a chance? And because we hadn't created many, if any, other real try scoring chances or proper scoring chances in the game, bar all the penalties, you're saying if we're going to win this, it's going to be a drop goal. So I'm sure in Johnny Sexton's own head, he was building up to that moment that if I do get the opportunity to drop out and to receive the ball, I've got to score a drop goal. And if I miss, we lose.
Yeah, we've heard from him in interviews afterwards that he was trying to make up for his missed penalty and he wanted another chance. Now, the one thing you'd be saying is, like, I remember thinking myself, just as we always do whenever any team gets in that situation, you'd love to have Ron O'Gara there for that, because Johnny is known for doing those moments. And then we just saw what is probably a flaw that follows him. That kick was from the same position that haunted him from that New Zealand game. You know, he's missed every now and again. Like, there's huge gaps in between it, but every now and again, a pressure kick, he misses it. So it just leaves that little question mark over his temperament in the ridiculous pressure situations. But in fairness to him, what a response. You know, for the guy to turn around and demand the ball at that situation, because, like, if you were in half, Ireland were in control of that game, you know, at that time they were making good, you know, yardage with the ball. You should have waited a few more phases, but the fact that he was ready, which gave him, once he snapped it back, France weren't ready for it either, so there was nobody charging him down, so he had a full wind up for it. And, you know, my hat is completely off to him. It was an absolutely amazing occasion, but it doesn't take away from a game that had many, many flaws for Ireland.
Yeah, and we heard earlier on from Joe Schmidt who was saying that he wasn't sure if the kick actually had the pace to make it over the bar, and thankfully it did. And of course, a few minutes earlier he'd missed a penalty to make it 15-6, and France then went and got their try and conversion and were leading right until the very end. Shane, just talk me through what would have been going through, you know, Johnny's head there, and the risk involved from his point of view in that position, because as we said, if he missed it, it's game over, and he did take a big risk. Thankfully for us, it paid off.
Yeah, well, look, that's the measure of the man is simply the fact is that we learned afterwards, because it did, like, it was one of those kicks that everybody would have screamed at the telly for a split second when he hit it. It was no, like, oh no, like, don't do it now. The same as the crossfield kick, but the bravery of the guy, you know, the kahunas, to be honestly, like, to do those things, to execute those moves, is just shows the quality of the player, because a lot of the players can shrink away from that after, as you say, missing a kick to put them clear, technically put them out of sight of a try, one score that France would have had to score twice. And it was just how he responded to it was superbly, and then to get afterwards that's exactly what he was looking for. He was looking for the opportunity to have one more goal, which is exactly what you want from an out half. That's, if you play that position, you put that 10 jersey on your back, you have to be able to step up and take the opportunities. And, you know, as I said, Ron O'Gara had many flaws at 10 and some of the things he was best in the world at, but one of his greatest qualities was that if there was ever an opportunity to take a drop kick, he would be there to take it. He would be the man to do it. And Johnny Sexton was that man yesterday. There was no doubt about it.
really interested listening to the coverage yesterday on all of the TV stations, and Luke Fitzgerald said, you know, at the time when the 83rd minute came and the drop goal came, that that's how Johnny Sexton starts and finishes every training session that he does, is to practice these. And to practice these, you know, in UCD where Leinster train with nobody watching bar maybe some of his teammates and some of his coaches. But that saying of practice making perfect is very true in that sense, that he's done it so many times, even though there's, you know, over 80,000 people there, it's a huge, huge pressure situation for him. But the practice he's done over the years really stood him in good stead in those types of situations.
But that's key to it. These world superstars that we see, it's not just the simple fact that they've amazing talent, they've amazing abilities. It's their work rate, it's their work ethic to see them to that point. Johnny Sexton had hit that drop goal in training hundreds and hundreds of times. And in his mind, he'd played out this exact scenario hundreds and hundreds of times. And, you know, Brian O'Driscoll was an unbelievably hard trainer. To me, one of the greatest examples of that, another out half, was Johnny Wilkinson. Like, if that guy had no talent whatsoever, he trained so hard, he still would have been an amazing player. And Johnny Sexton has so much talent, as we know, and so much ability, but yet he's still, his work ethic is an absolute shining beacon and an example to all young aspiring players out there, is that no matter who you are or what you do, you have to train, you have to work hard, and you have to perfect your skill set. And these are the exact moments that was needed for that. Johnny Sexton hit a 45-metre drop goal in the last second to win a game in Paris. And that's exactly what those moments are for.
Shane, the back page of the Irish Daily Mail headline is Drop of Magic, and the Irish Sunday Mirror goes, Cheers Johnny, deadly boot of Sexton, Nick's unlikely late win for Ireland in Paris. And we do need to just take a step back and realise, you know, Shane, the performance overall, we were losing the game towards the end because, you know, we hadn't been able to create anything bar the penalties in the match. And that has to be a concern for Joe and everybody moving forward. Me watching, I was bored. I didn't really enjoy the match, of course, the most exciting end you could think of. But we need to just ensure that the result doesn't overshadow what was a performance that lacked a lot.
Yeah, massively so. It's kind of a hard game to analyse after the fact, because it, you know, that moment at the end was such an absolutely huge thing. But Ireland didn't play well, and I thought they tactically played into France's hands. As in, it was a game, some games you have to you have to control the game. Like, Ireland kicked the ball up in the air and put pressure on the opposition to see how they respond. But this was one game where I honestly thought France needed to be starved of the ball, and Ireland should have just kept the ball for long periods of time. France weren't playing particularly well, and we just kept kicking it back to them. And I think that was a mistake. I think the simple fact is that we actually played them back into the game. Now, there's many a different factor in it. I don't think Nigel Owens had a good game. I thought he got dubbed by the French with the HIA. I think he missed a lot of ruck time. He wasn't looking outside the ruck for offside, which they were a lot, you know, because they were panicking about the wraparound. There were things like that, but it was still, there's very few players who you can point at and go, no, he played well. Like, the back line didn't play brilliantly, you know, almost to a man, you know, outside of 10. You couldn't point to anyone and go, yeah, look, he had a cracker. They all made errors. They all made simple mistakes. You know, in the forwards, there were guys who battled hardy. Word of note goes to James Ryan. I thought he was absolutely fantastic on his Six Nations debut. I thought he was one of the absolutely vital cogs in the wheel for Ireland. And, you know, Dan Levy, when he came on, Josh van der Fleer, when he was on the pitch, all these guys were playing well. But it was, if put it this way, if that drop goal had been missed by Johnny Sexton, Ireland would have been absolutely slated for performance, for a game, possession-wise, that they always looked in control of, but just never, you know, managed to push the scoreboard far enough away that the game was over and never looked like scoring a try. And these are big, big issues we got to look at.
Yes, and I'm sure it's an issue that I know Joe Schmidt spoke about, looking at video and looking at training this week. And one man I'm sure he may be looking at is Jordan Larmour, Shane. We spoke last weekend and I asked you if you felt that, you know, Jordan could play a part in this Six Nations. And if we're looking for someone to be a little bit creative in next week's home match against Italy on Saturday, Jordan Larmour surely has to be in Joe's head for that.
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? I still am not convinced that he's had enough time that Joe will use him yet. You got to remember, we've Carberry sitting in the wings as well. Like, they're another, until Larmour came on the scene, Carberry was the great attacking hope that we had in Irish rugby as well. Like, the way the fantastic way he plays rugby. I do expect changes. I don't expect to stay the same against Italy. You know, not just as Italy now do, you know, create more of a challenge than they used to. You can't disrespect them by changing your team completely. But a little bit of more attack-orientated backline, I think, would be very much welcomed. It is something that Larmour can play wing, full back. Carberry can come in as full back. You know, these are options I think Joe should start looking at now, because the game plan, as I say, against France, to me, was the wrong game plan. So we've got to start looking at other options, because this Six Nations is still going to be very, very competitive.
I'm sure, Shane, if you were to ask any of the players, Joe Schmidt, any of the fans, would you prefer performance or results? We'd all say result at the end of the day. If you can get both, great. But last night we got the main one, which was the results. What does this result do for setting up the rest of the championship for Ireland, the possible Grand Slam, possibly winning the championship overall? Because up until Johnny Sexton kicked that drop goal last night, you're going, things aren't looking very good here at all. And now we've won the game and things are all rosy heading into Italy, hopefully.
Well, I put this into perspective. You know, okay, we've been negative enough about the way Ireland played and, you know, a couple of individual performances. But it's, you know, Ireland have only won a handful of times there since the Second World War, since the 40s. You know, since the 70s, you know, if only three times. You know, it was a huge achievement to head over there and get a win. No matter what side you were playing against, no matter how you performed, you know, the record books will show a win. You know, the scoreboard doesn't tell a story, and that's exactly how it is. And the Six Nations is all about momentum. This was the fixtures this year sit very, very well for Ireland. One away game, which we've won, and now we've three home games, which is a superb opportunity to gather momentum. And that's what the Six Nations is all about. We've seen so many teams, unlikely or not, Wales, I suppose, are one of the best ones at it, that when they get momentum going, like as they did, say, in 05 when they won the Grand Slam, that was just built purely on momentum and just getting ugly wins. And you know, we'll take that in the Six Nations. It's over in such a short space of time. One team that is setting the pace normally can see that through. And wouldn't it be great for a video reel if it was set? Normally you have a drop kick to win a championship, but a drop kick to set it off would be something fantastic.
Shane Byrne, as always, thanks very much, Shane. We'll speak to you next Sunday as well in the aftermath of Ireland against Italy, which is at the Aviva Stadium next weekend. Thanks, Shane.
No worries, man. Take care.
Now, still to come on the That's What I Call Sport here on Dublin's 98FM, we are going to go big on the Dubs with four of the teams in action this weekend. And then a very interesting man called Mike Calvin, who has made a documentary and written a book called No Hunger in Paradise, will tell us why English Premier League clubs are identifying young talent as young as 3 years of age. We're back in a second.
98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport.
With the Liverpool Football Club Store at ILAC Centre. Home to the new LFC home kit. Celebrating 125 years of history.
Yes, the texts and WhatsApps are flying in on 0877 98 98 98 trying to win a family pass to go and see Dubs doubleheader at Croke Park next weekend. It's on February 10th, which is on next Saturday. The ladies footballers in action at 5 o'clock and the men then throwing in at 7. If you'd like to be there, you got a text or WhatsApp up the Dubs, plus your name and where you are, and the number you need is 0877 98 98 98. That's up the Dubs, plus your name and where you are on text or WhatsApp, and the number again 0877 98 98 98. The Dublin footballers playing against Donegal and the ladies against Cork and Derek. The Dublin footballers were in action also last night. Two wins from two for Jim Gavin's team in the Allianz League.
Yeah, good win for Dublin, has to be said. A superb second half display, mostly away to Tyrone last night. Tyrone, pretty impressive, and actually started the game quite well. I led 1-7 to 1-5 at the break, but Dublin kicked on in the second half then. Onal Gara scoring a goal. Niall Scully did get sent off for Dublin, but Onal Gara scored a goal late in the game to ensure that Dublin won the game. It was a 2-13 to 1-11 final score. And some good performances. Dean Rock scoring 4 points from frees. Colin Baskell scoring 3 points as well. So some good performances last night for Dublin. Way to Tyrone, and a good win on the cards as well.
Yeah, from the Dublin footballers to the hurlers. We're going to hear now from Danny Sutcliffe, who is a footballer. He played football in New York City last year. He's in a starting 15 though today for the hurlers for the Allianz Hurling League game away to Antrim. He's been out of action and out of the Dublin hurling scene since 2015, taking a break after a reported fallout with the former Dublin hurling manager, Jerry Cunningham. And he has been outlining, answering those questions to Off the Ball, Stephen Doyle, this week.
Look, that, like, I got to do everything on my own terms. It was nothing to do with a manager, nothing to do with players or how it was going. I was going away anyway, regardless of how good it was going. So at the end of the day, people forget in Ireland it's a hobby and you can't let that dictate your plans or your career or anything. So I was going regardless. So, yeah, my own terms. And just fortunate that I was asked back by the manager, and like most people now, if you perform well in club championship with the trials we had, you're given a chance, and that's all you're asked for. So that's the way it is at the moment.
So why is he back in the Dublin hurling fold?
I suppose I was away, living away, working away, and I'd no really plans to. I was more concerned playing my club again more than anything. Wasn't really a chance to stay on with the visa situation there. But no, it was just contact with Pat, and obviously knowing what he's done with the football, it's kind of changed the culture of Dublin football, and Mickey Whelan having the chance to be involved with them. So that's all it was. It was just an offer to come back in. It wasn't automatically on the team, but you know, it's a brilliant setup, great environment involved in, and obviously now I'm getting to the wrong side of my 20s now, so I'm kind of one of the mature ones now looking to bring in. There's 18, 19 year olds there now who are looking for examples, and you have to be there for them, so that's the job at the moment.
Yes, and the job for later on today is to go and try and beat Antrim. It's a 2 o'clock throw-in in Belfast, and Danny has been telling Off the Ball Stephen Doyle more about today's game and why he's back.
Yeah, well, I suppose like people have, you know, talking about Galway and Limerick, like Antrim obviously ran them for 3 points. Galway awfully ran Kilkenny's 3 points in the Welsh Cup. We're not taking them any lightly, differently than we would at Galway or Limerick. So if Antrim had won on Sunday, we still would have been taking the same. We're preparing ourselves, we're not worrying about what anyone else is doing, so you can't be looking outside the window the whole time. You know, we need to get our own house in order, so that's what we're doing.
Danny, just looking back at the few years, the last couple of years, Dublin hurling, it seems to have kind of taken a step, well, it has taken a step back, you know. Do you have any regrets yourself that you weren't around, maybe just to kind of, I suppose, help the team?
No regrets. Like, you can't, I suppose it's like I'm playing, you can't second guess yourself. Like, I'd never, this decision's always right at the time, I feel. So look, it was tough watching because I'd be close friends with the lads, but wasn't something I was going to be a part of. I was away, as I said, I just plans to be away and work, and you have to do that. Like, so at the end of the day, you know, I was going anyway. So, but look, as you said, it was tough watching, but now I'm back, I'm trying to contribute and help them. Like, there's 18, 19 year olds there who would have been babies when I first came in, so I'm trying to, you know, I wouldn't say take them under the wing, but just, you know, to be there looking for a template to look up to, what way, like, you know, to map out where they're going. Someone who's done it, like I done it with Conor Keeney, so I'm sure me, him, Johnny, Shane Durkin have to do this now for Killian Costlow, Ronan Hayes from Croaks, who are now 18, 19 coming in, baby foals coming in. But that's all it is. We're just trying to contribute and help and build that what we had. Like, we had a good team ethos and we're a close group as well, and that should transfer onto the pitch as well.
When you mentioned earlier about the impressive setup that Pat Gilroy has kind of brought to Dublin hurling, do you think maybe if the setup was better over the last couple of years that it might have stopped you from doing what you actually did then in the last couple of years, that took you away from the game?
No, again, I don't want to reiterate it, but it was just, like, I was going regardless. So if it was going well, or if I was going well, or if I was playing poorly, I was still going. Like, you only have one go at that grab visa, so I made my mind up going into college that I was I'd take it, you know. So no, it was nothing to do with that, and to be honest with you, I'd probably know. I wasn't thinking of even playing. I was more considered, like, we're club players at the end of the day, so Jews is the most important thing. And I was just, what, that's the only thing, games I was following when I was in America, like my club championship, which didn't go well for them. But I wasn't following the Dublin hurling at all, and then just got contact with Pat, and probably just chatting away, we weren't even chatting with hurling. And then we all know, like, he changed the culture of Dublin football, so I knew I didn't want to miss that train. So he just offered me a chance to come in, that's all it was, a chance to come in, that's all I've got.
Pat will definitely put the panel through the mill. Like, he likes to break teams down, and I suppose he survives after that.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, there might be a few casualties over the next couple of months?
No, like, geez, like, you could be one myself if not playing well. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to, like, you have to come in and perform. Like, everything else is there for us. Like, he's doing everything else, and then it's up to us then to get the results, and that's what we have to do. So, and that's our Sunday, you know. So, no, just no, it wouldn't. Everyone, like, look, it's fair. It's a competitive environment. If you're playing well, you're in. If you're not, you're out. That's myself included. That's everyone included, you know. So, and that's the best way to have it. Like, it's pretty similar to footballers. If you're playing well, you're in. Like you seen there in Niall Scully last year, the footballers, his first year, and went the whole way and right through the last man to have the ball in the final when the whistle went. So it's like that now. If you're playing well, you're in, and that's a nice way. Not that you're driven by that, but it's nice to know that no one, if anyone's comfortable, you're in. Right, it's bad.
Yes, Antrim against Dublin in the Allianz Hurling League throws in today in Belfast at 2 o'clock. And Eric T, Dublin Camogie team in action today against Meath as well.
They are indeed. They're in the Little Woods Ireland Camogie League action today, looking for their first win still after three games so far. Their way to Meath, like I say, in Trim from 2 o'clock today. And Dublin have some big games coming up over the next few weeks. Meath today, then Waterford and Tip over the next few weeks. We've been chatting to Eamon McCarthy from the Dublin team this week, and she's been telling us about how big a few games they have now coming up over the next few weeks.
Yeah, we have three must-win games now coming up. So, you know, we're really driving on to get three wins out of these games and make the league semi-final.
Now, Dublin made the All-Ireland semi-final, as you mentioned there, last year. So does McCarthy think that teams are going to be raising their game, I suppose, against them this year compared to last year, and how more difficult that's going to be for them as well?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think, you know, everyone kind of, definitely in Camogie, everyone wants to get the top four teams. You want to get there. So I think people are kind of really kind of feeling, well, if you get over Dublin, you know, this is where we can be. This is where we can be. So that's kind of like, you know, that's also tough. But we're a hard team also to beat, you know. So hopefully not too many teams. Many more teams are going to get over us. So just a kind of a drive on now for the next few games.
Yeah, now Dublin had a pretty decent year last year, like I say, getting to the All-Ireland semi-final, but they obviously need to go a bit further this year. What do they feel is their recipe for success this year, and what does Eamon think the recipe for success this year is going to be to get them over that line?
You know, I do think it's like a little bit of kind of everything, and the team are phenomenally fit, which was commented on an awful lot last year. And you know, it's mindset kind of belief, but I think your fitness and stuff comes from that, because once you kind of back yourself, you're going to get fitter, and you're going to kind of drive on from that, and knowing that, you know, we are good and we are the best. And, you know, there is a firm belief there that in hopefully this year, you know, we can win the All-Ireland, and we will win it. We're here to, I think everyone's here to win, and, you know, it is one game at a time and stuff, but at the end of the day, every team sets goals, and that is our goal. So
yes, the Dublin against Meath in the Littlewoods Camogie League today, away in Trim from 2 o'clock this afternoon. So hopefully picking up a first win of the campaign, Jamie.
Yeah, you have to love the confidence there. Everyone is here to win, and we want to win. And not too many sports people generally say, you know, we're going for the All-Ireland in interviews.
Not in Ireland.
And especially in the Gads, like, well, the next game, and, you know, we're going through the process and all this. But
in Ireland, we're nearly afraid of confidence. I mean, Conor McGregor is slagged for being so confident. You know, maybe he goes a little bit too far sometimes, but he's slagged for showing confidence. In America, that's what you do. You know, if you're going for the Super Bowl tonight, you're talking about how you're definitely going to win the game. Whereas in Ireland, we kind of shy away from that a small bit, which is a bit weird.
Yes, now Derek from the Camogie to the ladies' footballers against Westmeath.
Absolutely, they're in action today. Away to Westmeath at St. Lomond's from 12:30 this afternoon. Early start to the game. They won their first game of the campaign last week away to Donegal. So good start for them in Division 1 of the Lidl National Football League. Leah Caffrey has been chatting to us this week and looking ahead to the game as well.
Yeah, with me, they're very strong. We played them in the last two Leinster finals. So, like, they have a lot of experience. We have a lot of experience playing against them. But it's always a tough challenge. So we're looking forward to Sunday.
Now, it's a big year for the Dublin ladies, because they have, I think, three double headers coming up over the next few weeks. Cork, Mayo and Kerry, double headers, two of them at Croke Park as well. So it's a really big year to, I suppose, show off what they can do. Last year they got to the All-Ireland Final and obviously had that record crowd for the All-Ireland Final. So a big chance for the Dublin ladies to show what they can do to maybe fans who wouldn't maybe see them an awful lot in big games over the next few weeks. And Leah has been chatting about that as well this week.
So it's important for like the fans to get in if they get in a bit early and watch our game and see that like it's just as exciting or like it's just as competitive. Like there's a high level of skill in the girls' game as well, so it'd be great just to get that support as well for us, because it's definitely going to be a close game. With we have double headers for the Cork, the Kerry and the Mayo game, and they're all going to be very tough games. The double headers are a good platform to like promote the ladies' game, like the end goal would definitely be for us to just play on our own and to have large support like following us, and so hopefully like if people come along to the double headers, they'll come along to our other games which won't be double headers, and we can get a bigger fan base. Yeah.
Now if you would like to head along to one of said double headers at Croke Park this coming Saturday, February 10th, we've got a family pass for you to win on 98FM right now. You've got a text or WhatsApp up the Dubs, plus your name and where you are, and the number you need is 0877 98 98 98. It's to see the ladies in the Little National League action against Cork, 5 o'clock throw-in, and the Allianz Football League, the Dubs footballers against Donegal at 7. Up the Dubs, plus your name and where you are, on text or WhatsApp. That number again, 0877 98 98 98. And on the way after the break, author and TV documentary maker Mike Calvin on why Premier League clubs are giving thousands and thousands of pounds a week to people under the age of 12 to play football for them.
98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport.
With the Liverpool Football Club Store at ILAC Centre, home to the new LFC Home Kit, celebrating 125 years of history.
You're on the That's What I Call Sport on 98FM. It's Jamie Moore here on Sunday. Now, if you are a young aspiring footballer, a parent, a coach, an agent, or anyone else with an interest in the journey young Irish teens, English teens and so on go through to chase their dreams in UK soccer academies, you better take a listen to this. I'm delighted to welcome author and presenter of No Hunger in Paradise, an award-winning book and very recent TV documentary on BT Sport, Mike Calvin, back to 98FM again. Mike, how are you?
I'm very well, Jamie. You?
Great, thanks, Mike. Thanks very much for joining us. I know you spoke to us last year about your book about football managers living on a volcano. You have a new book and TV show out on BT Sport. And one of the opening lines in the documentary is from a parent of an 8-year-old kid at Chelsea who turned down 7 other Premier League clubs. And her quote is, "I'm anxious about the life I'm pushing my child into." Mike, for those who are unaware of what that life that the parents are either pushing the kids into, but the life that many of these kids, if not all of them, dream about every night, tell us what that life is actually like in the UK for a young kid in an academy.
Well, I suppose it crosses borders, the dream, and it's, you know, I try to understand the power of that great dream that is essentially about overcoming the odds and becoming a professional footballer. And what odds? If you look at it in the English context, only 180 of the 1.5 million boys who play organised youth football in England at any one time will become a Premier League pro, i.e. they'll play a minute in the Premier League. Now, that's a success rate of 0.012%. And similarly, you know, I don't wish to rain on the parade of the mums and dads who are probably listening to this, taking their kids to you know, the Sunday morning matches, but less than half of 1% of boys who enter academies at the age of 9 will make a living from the game. So those dropout rates are terrifying, and I suppose it begs the question, which I've tried to address in the book and the film, is who picks up the pieces? Because even the survivors, those ones who go through the system and actually make a living out of the game, probably need better guidance and more structured advice, because it's quite an under-regulated world populated by agents. Parents get ahead of themselves far too often. And, you know, essentially, I suppose, in a phrase, what I tried to ask was, look, what is football doing to our kids?
Yes, and Mike, the question posed in the documentary is, do the academy kids themselves and the parents understand how tough the industry actually is? It's described by one of your contributors as a brutal environment. What is that environment actually like, if you can try and take us inside a UK academy for a young Irish or English kid who's 14, 15, 16, who's just starting off? They think they're going to go and live their dream, but for a lot of them, as we said, the stats say not too many make it. It's a very difficult environment to be in.
Yeah, well, to be honest, Jamie, you talk about 14, 15, 16, and that is one aspect of it. What is actually happening, because there's now a race to the bottom going on in professional football. It's about finding that golden child as young as possible. You know, there are instances of a three-year-old being approached by a club. Certainly, and, you know, and that's not typical, but that has happened. But there, you know, we have what we call now the pre-academy phase, which is boys between the ages of 6 and 9. The recruitment there is more cutthroat almost than it is at senior level. And, you know, you hear of, you know, coaches, when I was doing the research, coaches were talking about a nine-year-old boy being paid £24,000 a year through his parents, completely illicitly. But these stories are too common to be dismissed as pure fantasy, and they come from very, very reliable sources. What you have, if you try and take as an example, let's take the northwest of England. Even the smaller clubs like, you know, Crewe Alexandra have got a history of producing young players. But in that sort of conurbation, the Manchester-Liverpool area, there are boys, and I've spoken to their parents, who are 5 and 6 years old, and they will go to Manchester United one night, Manchester City next, Everton the next, Liverpool the next. They're picked up from school, and they're eating in the back of the car on the way to a session. And I think when you have that concentration and a mania for young talent, they're boys, they're children. You know, let's get that 100% right. And you hear of parents who, frankly, you know, make me shudder sometimes. And I'm speaking as a parent whose son went through the academy system, and they have a completely unreal view of what is going to occur. They think that. That riches are guaranteed, that fame is a near certainty. Well, it's not. You know, we've already talked about the figures, but it's the stress that it puts on the boys, and it's, you know, I've heard of, you know, parents putting floodlights in the back garden so little Jimmy can kick a ball around in the winter at 8 o'clock at night.
Well,
you know, you hear of. You know, there's one parent who's apparently put down a 3G pitch in his garden for the same sort of reason. There is a huge pressure on these boys very early on, and it manifests itself. There's a really good phrase which I think is really applicable in this sense. It's premature professionalism.
Yeah.
So by that, I mean, if you look at the boy who signed up an academy at 9, he's encouraged to believe, maybe subliminally, but certainly, you know, by some very unwise parents, that this is your job. And so you treat that as a job from, say, 9 until 16, when the occasion comes where you're either kept on as a scholar or you're lost. When that happens, a lot of boys get to see. I was talking to Sean Dyshear about this a couple of weeks ago, and Sean made the point. He sees boys get to, say, 16, and essentially all the joy and the life has been sucked out of them because it's been they've had to deal with the pressure of this being their job, in inverted commas, from the age of 9. They get to 16 and there's nothing left. They're overwhelmed. Now, that same boy, if he was given more time to be a boy, to be a child, to be someone who plays multi-sports, who has a normal social life with his school friends, who is encouraged to cultivate extra interests, who is told the importance of education, a longer education, a much more balanced lifestyle, those boys are now beginning to appear at, say, 18, and they've fallen out of the professional systems, but actually they bounce back, these type of boys, because they haven't had that day in, day out, you must be a mini-pro. Just like we're expecting boys to be mini-adults, it just does not work.
Mike, let's stay in the theme of parents for now, and parents living out their own dreams through their children, and
We spoke already about agents and coaches, and a lot of these academies have lots of coaches and sports psychologists and all of the above, a lot of whom can be very good. But you make the point in the documentary about the amount of voices in the ears of these young players, and they're unable to think or make any choices for themselves because they've got so many people with an interest in them telling them so many different things.
Yeah, what I found interesting, Jamie, during the filming, we went to the Brit School, which produced, you know, Adele, Amy Winehouse, dancers, performers. And it was a really interesting contrast in atmosphere and ethos between that sort of arts-based, it wasn't, you know, virtually, it's a school, but it's virtually an academy, and the football academy. And the principal, a guy called Stuart Warden, it actually came across brilliantly, I thought, in the film. And he made the point that, you know, when he's been approached by football clubs, his study of their culture is that football is essentially a culture of fear, whereas the Brit School Performing Arts want to create an environment of freedom. And he made the point that the young footballer has far too many voices in his ear. He has the parent, he has the coach, he has the academy manager, he has an agent, he has maybe a stylist, whatever it is. And at that age, and when you're at that age, you cannot, you know, you cannot have that many voices in your ear. And in artistic terms, what they do is divorce the boys and girls from the industry for which they're being prepared, whereas football basically hits them smack on in the face with, look, you know, you're in a harsh, highly commercialized business, just happens to be called professional football. And I put that sort of contrast to Les Reed, who is the basically defines all the football policy at Southampton, which is a very good academy. And he agreed with it. He said, you know, the there are two types of voices in a child's ear or a boy's ear. And you know, the most pernicious one and the quite common one is one who have the one from people who have an ulterior motive. They want something from that boy. What they try to do as an institution at Southampton, and as I say, other enlightened academies do the same, similar things, is to almost become surrogate parents, so that they actually take a broader view of the lifestyle, of the demands that are placed on a boy, because their view very much is that beyond the sort of financial advantages of selling homegrown players in the sort of medium to long term, when you have a homegrown player at a football club, it increases the sense of identity of that football club and the bond, it reinforces the bond between the supporters and the team, which, you know, we live in an age in professional football where certainly in Premier League clubs, the player has never been further away spiritually, financially, from the supporters who we like to think pay their wages, but they don't, because we all know that the TV companies pay their wages now.
Yes, and we have to say as well, we're not totally having a go at the academies. The academies in general, certainly the top ones, as you said, Mike, the players are treated well. The facilities are second to none. I know of a young player travelling up to an FA Youth Cup game this week. They're going to stay in a hotel overnight. They're going on a fantastic Ellison's coach with Sky Sports News, coffee machines, all you can think of. But again, the question is, when they reach the end of their first contract, or if they're lucky enough to get a second contract, what happens next? And that's the final part that I'd like to focus on with you, Mike. And you mentioned the Brit School and the absence of fear that those children are developed under. Who's there when the tears fall and the dream dissolves is a question you ask. And does football pay attention to the duty of care it has for these young people? One answer was absolutely nothing about lifestyle advice given to players. And for a boy as young as six to be discarded for having bad habits. So what happens next to these kids, whether they be six, 16, even 20. I know there's a couple of young men in the documentary who are maybe a little bit older when they get released. What happens to them support-wise from clubs, from PFA and that sort of stuff, or is it just left to them and their parents to literally pick up the pieces of a dream that they feel has been shattered?
Yeah, I don't think the PFA do a good enough job, to be quite frank, in that area. There is an organisation I've seen work, and as a result of the film and the documentary, I think a lot more people are aware of what they do. They're called the Players Trust, and it's an independent, not-for-profit organisation which offers sort of mentorship programmes, but essentially what they do is offer free, instantly available, confidential counselling services. So they're not part of the club structure or the football system, and that's really important because time and again you hear when you speak to people in the academy structures, and this is parents, that they feel that they don't have a voice, because if they do voice their misgivings, or they don't turn up for training because, I don't know, a family wedding or whatever, that will be held against them. And I do think it's fair to say that football ritually, at all levels, exploits fear and insecurity. So these Players Trust people, and I've put some parents in touch with them who had issues, and they were very, very effective. Just to put it, basically, they had some seed funding from Sir Alex Ferguson, who saw the need for that sort of transitional support for young players who are going out of the game. And as you mentioned rightly, Jamie, it's 6 to 22. Arsene Wenger spoke very well in the film about the morality of the whole process, and he made the point also that 2/3 of the boys who are given a pro contract at 19 are out of the game by the time they're 22.
Yeah, and some other interesting contributors on the documentary, former manager and now a car salesman who owns a garage, Brian Laws, talks about a kid getting a lotto ticket and given millionaire status when he has never played a first team game. What other industry would do that? Stephen Gerrard asked a question about, do these young players still have the hunger and determination to be pros? And a really powerful quote from Joey Barton, who apparently made a speech to an academy at one time and basically said to the kids, are you going to come in and take my jersey? I'm playing in the first team. Are you coming to take my jersey? And as you mentioned about Phil Giles from Brentford, along with Huddersfield, about closed down their academies because they felt that it didn't make business sense to run an academy, spend so much money with the stats not in favour of these players making it. Mike, I love how you finished the documentary. The very final quote says, football is a people business that doesn't always treat people well. Celebrate achievement, cherish the dream, protect the innocent, is how you chose to finish off the movie.
Yeah, and they are innocent, and I think that's the thing that's often forgotten in the whole process. The young boys who have a modicum of talent, and they have a life stretching before them, and their life won't be defined in the vast majority of cases by the fact that whether or not they play professional football. They're kids, treat them as kids, and just let them play.
That's the voice of Mike Calvin, the author and the maker of the TV documentary No Hunger in Paradise. And Mike, people, if they want to read the book is very in-depth. They'll find it in all good bookstores, and the BT documentary, I'm sure they'll find online. It's definitely on the BT Sport website and on YouTube as well, and it's well worth a watch or a read. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
That is it for another week. Totally out of time here on the That's What I Call Sport. Anita Doyle in Clontarf, well done. You've won a family pass for the Dubs doubleheader at Croke Park next Saturday. We've been touching you straight after the show. We're back live next Sunday from 9 a.m. We'll reflect on those Dubs games, plus Ireland against Italy in the Six Nations. Have a great Sunday, folks. See you later. Bye-bye.
98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport.
With the Liverpool Football Club Store at ILAC Centre, home to the new LFC Home Kit. Celebrating 125 years of history.
Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, folks. Bye-bye.
98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport.
Back live this Sunday morning from 9.
98FM.